All right, everyone, welcome back to the show for a deep dive. This should be pretty interesting.
Yeah, this one is definitely unique and kind of wild, to be honest.
It is, and as lawyers and law students, we see a lot of crazy stuff, but this case is something else.
Yeah, Brown v. Hot, Sexy and Safer Productions. It's not every day you see a case name like that.
Not at all. So, to set the scene, we're going back to 1992, Chelmsford High School in Massachusetts. Picture this. You're a 15-year-old sitting in a mandatory assembly. You think, okay, AIDS awareness, important topic, probably going to be a, maybe a little awkward lecture from a health teacher. But no, instead you get.
Susie Landolfi and her company, Hot, Sexy, and Safer Productions. And they did not hold back.
No, they did not. From what I've read, this assembly was basically a full-on sex ed show, complete with.
Oh, yeah, sexually suggestive skits with students from the audience, graphic language describing sexual acts, even simulated masturbation.
Yeah, I can already hear the gasps from parents listening to this. Like, no opt out, no prior notice. Just boom, your kid comes home having seen all that.
Right, and that's exactly what led to the lawsuit. The parents were furious. They felt like the school had completely overstepped its bounds.
And understandably so. I mean, think about the era, too. 1992, AIDS is still a relatively new and a very scary disease. There's a lot of fear and misinformation swirling around.
Definitely. And that context is important, I think. It helps explain why the parents reacted so strongly. They were probably already on edge about the whole AIDS issue, and then this assembly comes along and just throws all these really explicit images and ideas at their kids.
It's like throwing gasoline on a fire.
Yeah.
So, okay, the parents sue the school. What exactly were their legal arguments? I imagine they threw everything that the kitchen sink at them.
They pretty much did. They argued violation of privacy, due process rights, free exercise of religion. They even brought up a Title IX hostile environment claim.
Wow, okay, so a pretty wide range of legal theories. What was the school's defense? Did they just say, hey, we're trying to educate kids about a serious issue, deal with it?
Well, the case first went to federal district court, and the judge actually dismissed it right away.
Really? So the judge didn't even think the parents had a case worth hearing.
Not at that stage. They basically said the parents' claims weren't strong enough to move forward to a full trial.
Ouch. It's got to be a tough pill to swallow. But I'm guessing the parents didn't give up there, right?
Nope. They appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, but they lost again.
Oh, wow. So two courts basically said, nope, not seeing it. How did the appeals court justify that decision? I mean, this whole thing seems pretty outrageous on the surface.
It does seem that way, right? But to really get it, we need to break down each legal argument and how the court analyzed it.
Okay, let's do that. Let's start with substantive due process. I know that's a big one in constitutional law, but can you give us a quick refresher on what it means in plain English?
Sure. Basically, substantive due process is the idea that the government can't deprive you of life, liberty, or property without a really good reason and following fair procedures. It's got to be justified and not arbitrary or completely unfair.
So in this case, the parents were arguing that the assembly was so offensive, so beyond the pale, that it violated their kid's fundamental right to due process.
Exactly. They were saying this wasn't just bad judgment, it was government overreach that went against basic principles of fairness.
Interesting. So, how did the court respond to that? Did they agree that the assembly was shocking or outrageous?
Not really. The court said that while the assembly might have been offensive or disturbing to some, it didn't rise to the level of a constitutional violation.
So, being offended isn't enough. What's the line here?
Right. That's the key question. And the court basically said that schools have a lot of leeway when it comes to curriculum decisions. They have to be able to teach about important topics, even if those topics are sensitive or controversial.
I guess that makes sense. Otherwise, you'd have parents suing over every little thing they disagreed with. Schools would be paralyzed.
Exactly. And the court didn't want to create a situation where every curriculum decision was subject to a legal challenge. They felt like that would undermine the whole education system.
So, one point for the school. Okay, what about procedural due process? What was the argument there?
So, with procedural due process, it's about fairness in the process itself. The parents argued that they should have been given notice about the assembly and a chance to opt their kids out, a heads up and a choice.
Yeah, I think most parents would agree with that,
Yeah.
especially given the sensitive nature of the topic.
Right, but here's where it gets tricky. The court basically said that parents can always choose alternative schooling if they disagree with what public schools are teaching.
So they're saying if you don't like it, send your kids to a private school or homeschool them.
Essentially. But they also said that parents don't get to micromanage every single lesson in a public school.
Ah, so it's about preventing a curriculum by veto situation. Interesting.
Exactly. The court was worried that if every parent had the power to pull their kid out of any lesson they objected to, it would create chaos and make it impossible for schools to function effectively.
Okay, so that's two claims down, two to go. Let's move on to Title IX. For those who might not be familiar, can you give us a quick rundown of what Title IX is all about?
Of course, Title IX is a federal law that prohibits sex-based discrimination in any educational program or activity that receives federal funding. So it's about ensuring equal opportunities for all students, regardless of gender.
Right. So how did the parents try to apply Title IX to this assembly? It was mandatory for all students, so it wasn't like girls were being singled out or anything.
True. But one of the ways Title IX is enforced is through the concept of a hostile environment. This means that students have a right to an educational environment free from discrimination, harassment, or anything that's so severe and pervasive that it denies them equal access to education.
Got it. So were they arguing that the assembly itself created a hostile environment because of the explicit sexual content?
Yeah, that was their argument. They were saying it was so over the top that it created a discriminatory atmosphere, even though everyone was required to attend.
Bold argument. What did the court have to say about that?
They weren't convinced. The court said that to prove a hostile environment claim under Title IX, you have to show that the harassment was severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive.
And one assembly, even one as graphic as this, didn't meet that bar.
Right. They said that one assembly doesn't automatically create a hostile environment, especially since there was no evidence that the presenters were specifically targeting female students.
So it's not just about being offended. It's about a pattern of behavior and the intent behind it. Okay, that makes sense. What about the final claim, the free exercise clause argument?
So with that one, the parents were arguing that the assembly violated their religious freedom because they objected to the content.
I can see how some people might have religious objections to that kind of material. What was the court's response?
Well, they basically said that parents do have the right to choose alternative forms of education for their children if they have strong religious objections to what's being taught in public schools. You know, things like religious schools or homeschooling.
Right. But they can't just pick and choose which lessons their kids are exposed to within a public school.
Exactly. The court was drawing a line between opting out of the whole system versus trying to censor individual lessons within a public school.
So in the end, the court sided with the school on all four counts.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like this case really gets at that fundamental tension between parental rights and the authority of schools to decide what's taught in the classroom.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a tension that's still very much alive today, as we're seeing with all the debates about sex education, critical race theory, and other hot button topics.
It's like no matter what you teach, someone's going to be upset. So how do you find that balance? Where do you draw the line?
That's the million-dollar question. And it's one we'll keep exploring as we continue our deep dive into Brown v. Hot, Sexy, and Safer productions. So we left off talking about how the court really sided with the school on all those arguments from the parents.
Yeah. Pretty decisive ruling. But I'm still kind of stuck on the fact that they let this assembly happen in the first place. I mean, even if it's legally sound, it just seems like terrible judgment. You know?
Right. It definitely raises questions about what schools should be doing, not just what they're allowed to do. Yeah. Like, ethically speaking, was this really the best way to teach kids about AIDS awareness?
Exactly. It feels like there must have been less... let's say, shocking ways to get the message across.
For sure. But I think it's important to remember the context, too. This was 1992. The AIDS epidemic was still relatively new, and there was a lot of fear and stigma surrounding it.
True. People were grasping for solutions, and maybe some folks thought that this kind of in-your-face approach was what was needed to really shake people up.
Right. Maybe they thought the traditional methods weren't working, and they needed to try something drastic.
I guess that's possible. But still, it's hard to imagine any school board today approving something like this.
Oh, definitely times have changed. But back then, there was this real sense of urgency about the AIDS crisis. And maybe that contributed to the school's decision to go with this particular program.
Yeah, maybe. But let's get back to the legal side of things. The court's decision in Brown, even though it sided with the school, it still provides a lot of food for thought, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It really highlights that constant tension between parental rights and the school's authority to make decisions about the curriculum.
And where that line gets drawn. Because on one hand, parents absolutely have a right to be involved in their children's education. But on the other hand, schools can't be expected to cater to every individual parent's preferences.
Right. It would be impossible to create a curriculum that everyone agreed with.
Exactly. And I think the court recognized that in Brown. They basically said that parents have the option to choose alternative schooling if they fundamentally disagree with what's being taught in public schools. But they don't get to dictate the curriculum for everyone.
Which makes sense when you think about it. Public schools are designed to serve a diverse community. And that means sometimes people will be exposed to ideas that they don't personally agree with.
That's part of living in a pluralistic society, I guess.
Yeah.
You're not always going to be surrounded by people who share your exact beliefs.
Right. And I think the court was trying to strike a balance between those competing interests, the parents' right to guide their children's education, and the school's responsibility to provide a well-rounded education to all students.
It's a tricky balance, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And one that I'm sure we'll continue to grapple with as a society.
Absolutely. This debate isn't going away anytime soon, especially in today's world where everything is so polarized.
Speaking of today's world, it's interesting to think about how Brown might play out if it happened in 2025 instead of 1992. I mean, the social and political landscape is so different now.
Oh, yeah. Imagine this case happening in the middle of the debates about critical race theory or sex education. It would be a total media frenzy.
No doubt. And I wonder how the court would rule. I mean, the legal principles from Brown would probably still apply. But the public reaction and the political pressure would be intense.
For sure. And that could definitely influence the outcome. It's hard to say for certain how a court would rule today, but it's something worth thinking about.
It is. It really makes you wonder how much our legal system is shaped by the social and political context of the time.
Oh, absolutely. The law is never truly neutral. It's always being interpreted and applied within a specific historical moment.
Which I guess is both exciting and a little bit scary. Because it means the law can change and adapt, but it also means it can be influenced by things like public opinion and political pressure.
Exactly. It's a double-edged sword. But that's what makes it so fascinating to study and to practice.
Well said. So listeners, what do you think? How would Brown v. Hot, Sexy, and Safer Productions play out in today's world? Let us know your thoughts. It's a complex issue with no easy answers. But hopefully our deep dive has given you some new perspectives to consider. All right, so we've talked about the facts of the case. We've looked at the court's reasoning, and we've even debated how this might play out in today's world. But let's shift gears a bit and put on our hypothetical thinking caps.
Yeah, let's do some what-if scenarios. Always fun to explore those.
Exactly. So let's say instead of a one-time assembly, this kind of explicit content was part of like a required textbook or a regular classroom lesson.
Mm.
Would that change the legal analysis at all?
Ooh, that's a good one. Because now you're talking about something that's woven into the core curriculum, not just a one-off event.
Right, and I imagine that would raise a lot more red flags for parents.
For sure. Parents tend to have a much stronger reaction when something is presented as required learning, as opposed to just like an optional assembly.
Because now it feels like the school is actively endorsing this material, not just exposing kids to it.
Exactly, and that goes back to that tension between parental rights and school authority. You know, how much, say, do parents get in what their kids are learning, especially when it comes to sensitive topics?
And how much leeway do schools have in choosing their curriculum? I mean, obviously, they can't just teach anything they want, but where do you draw the line?
Right. And I think the court in Brown kind of hinted at that line. They said that schools have broad discretion in choosing their curriculum, but that discretion isn't unlimited.
So there are boundaries, but they're kind of fuzzy.
Yeah, definitely. It's not always clear cut. And I think a lot would depend on the specific facts of the case, you know, the age of the students, the nature of the material, the context in which it's presented.
Okay, so let's try another hypothetical. What if instead of focusing on AIDS awareness, this assembly had been about something like, sex education in general, but with the same level of explicitness as the Brown assembly?
Interesting. So basically, we're keeping the format and the tone, but changing the topic. Would that make a difference, legally speaking?
That's the question. Because on one hand, you could argue that sex education is a legitimate topic for schools to cover.
Absolutely. It's essential, really.
Right. But on the other hand, the way it's presented matters. And I think most people would agree that there's a difference between teaching kids about the biology of sex and showing them simulated masturbation in a school assembly.
Yeah, that definitely crosses a line for most people.
And legally speaking, I wonder if a court would see it as going beyond the bounds of what's considered appropriate for a public school setting.
I think it might, especially in today's world where there's so much sensitivity around these issues.
Right back in 1992, maybe they could get away with it, but in 2025, it would be a much tougher sell.
No doubt. The social and political landscape has shifted so much, and I think that would have a big impact on how a case like this would be perceived and decided.
It's a reminder that the law isn't static. It's always evolving to reflect the changing values of society.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so interesting, right? It's not just a set of rules. It's a reflection of who we are as a society and what we believe in.
Well said. So as we wrap up this deep dive into Brown v. Hot, Sexy, and Safer Productions, what are some of the key takeaways you hope our listeners are walking away with?
I think the biggest one is that there's no easy answer when it comes to balancing parental rights and school authority. It's a complex issue with a lot of gray areas, and it requires careful consideration of all the competing interests.
And that context matters a lot. What might have been acceptable in 1992 might not fly in 2025 and vice versa.
Exactly. The law is constantly evolving, and we need to stay informed and engaged in these debates to ensure that it continues to reflect our values as a society.
Couldn't have said it better myself. So, listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this deep dive into Brown v. Hot, Sexy, and Safer Productions. It's a case that still has a lot to teach us even decades later. And it's a reminder that the law is a living, breathing thing that's constantly being shaped by the world around us. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.